Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am very pleased to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Jonathan Landay. He was a reporter for Knight Ridder during the selling of the 2003 begun war on Iraq, at which time articles he wrote with Warren Strobel were just about the only dissenting reporter voices in the corporate media. Jonathan Landay is now a reporter for McClatchy, based in Washington, D.C., and reporting on issues all over the world. Jonathan Landay, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Thank you for being a reporter who seems inclined to report facts. I'm very curious what you think about a couple of more recent initiatives to start wars. One, the failed attempt to launch missiles into Syria in 2013. The other, the successful attempt to start launching missiles into Iraq and Syria in 2014. Because it seems to me, and I'm curious what you think, the primary difference was not people's doubts about holes in the stories about the chemical weapons in 2013, but rather the threat to people who look and talk like you and me in the form of beheading videos in 2014. What made the difference, and what are we not being told about these war initiatives?
I think you hit something on the head, and that is the difference between the political circumstances here in the United States when the president, sort of off the cuff, came up with this red line that he described warning President Assad of Syria not to use chemical weapons. At that time, you know, American public opinion was dead set against any kind of new involvement in any kind of new war in the Middle East or just about anywhere. The president himself had run on promises of ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, had, at least in his mind, ended the war in Iraq. We know that not to that kind of doesn't really happen, and has changed his policy now on maintaining U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
Now, so, I could swear he ran on a promise to escalate the war in Afghanistan, and it was one of the few he kept. Am I mistaken?
Well, he called it the good war, but don't forget, he did want to get out of all wars, and he thought that by escalating the war in Afghanistan, you could, in fact, then claim victory. And we've seen this before. Don't forget, we saw what happened with Nixon in Vietnam. You escalate a war in order to be able to say, see, we put all of this time and money and sweat and blood and troops into this effort, and you, Afghans, or you, Vietnamese, in that case, the South Vietnamese, now it's your responsibility to pick up the slack and take over from us. And that is what we've seen indeed happen in Afghanistan. But going back to your original question, at the time that the president, as I said, made this off-the-cuff, set this off-the-cuff red line of for Assad not to use chemical weapons, U.S. domestic political feelings were dead set against any new military involvement in the Middle East. And we saw, in fact, how the president managed to avoid making good on his threat by suddenly, out of nowhere, having confirmed that the Syrians had, in fact, used chemical weapons, suddenly threw this decision to the Congress. I think that there was a lot of political calculation within the White House that this was a way out, an off-ramp, and that they knew that there was going to be, there was not going to be majority support for U.S. intervention. But now, fast forward to last summer, when we began having the first of the beheadings of Westerners who had been captured by the Islamic State, and the first being James Foley, a freelance journalist, and we had a second American freelance journalist then beheaded, and this had a major impact on domestic political atmosphere in that. Suddenly, you had a majority of Americans who were prepared to support at least intervention from the air against the Islamic State in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. but not, as they like to say, boots on the ground, although by early next year, we're going to have 3,000 boots on the ground.
Are there not already U.S. troops on the ground and, in fact, wearing boots and engaging?
Absolutely. We have, I think, somewhere in the vicinity of 1,200 to 1,500 American military advisors on the ground in Iraq. And that number is going to go up, I believe, by another 1,500 troops early in the coming year. And we're told these are going to be in advisory capacity and training capacities, and that the Americans themselves will not engage in combat in Iraq.
The echoes of Vietnam continue, although they apparently already are engaged in combat. You've written about the possible length of this operation as perhaps being much longer than people imagine. When American public opinion says, okay, we're in favor of such a thing, how long do people have in mind, and what do you think is actually going to happen?
Well, I think that as long as the airstrikes continue, the air operations continue in Iraq and Syria, and there are no major losses of American pilots to Islamic State gunfire or missile fire, that the American public will continue to support the president's policy. That doesn't mean that it's going to be a successful policy. We've seen some major setbacks dealt to the Islamic State in northern Iraq within the last several weeks. A lot of it with the support of American airstrikes and airstrikes by the Allies. But that doesn't mean that this is over by a long shot. Indeed, the Islamic State is sitting pretty next door in Syria. And as long as the Islamic State is able to maintain a sanctuary in Syria where it is the strongest of all of the insurgent groups that are fighting the Assad regime, then it's in good shape in Iraq because it merely uses Syria as a place where it can maintain weapon stocks and men. It shifts men back and forth across what used to be a border that everyone observed, but of course the Islamic State hasn't since it declared its so-called caliphate earlier this year. And as long as that safe zone exists for the Islamic State in Syria and there it is not contested on the ground, there's no reason to believe that it is going to be defeated in Iraq.
Has it not, in fact, seen, as it quite clearly expected and hoped to see, some recruitment advantages in being attacked in this way?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. There was a German reporter who spent time, the first Western reporter to spend any time with the Islamic State. He was in Mosul in northern Iraq. He was in various other places held by the Islamic State. And one of his observations was that hundreds of foreign jihadis are showing up in the Islamic State-controlled territories every day. And so, yes, I think that this is, you know, what we've seen is a shift of sort of the fight against the far powers, as Al-Qaeda likes to call it, the far enemy, which is the United States and the West, shift from Afghanistan and the Pakistan border, although it's still fairly fierce there, and shift to Syria and Iraq. These are the places where most of the foreign jihadis are now showing up.
We are speaking with Jonathan Lande, reporter for McClatchy. I wanted to ask you about Afghanistan. This week, they renamed that war, and the reporting rather obediently followed the line that the war is therefore ended. I wonder what your view of that ending is. And the president told us, without any evidence I'm aware of, that the war for the past 13 plus years has made us safer. Has it?
That's a really good question, David. I think it certainly kept the threat to the United States lower than it was when Al-Qaeda had a safe sanctuary in Afghanistan. It was essentially sort of a state within a state in Afghanistan when the Taliban were in charge, in that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were essentially funding the Taliban government and providing its shock troops. Some of the best troops that the Taliban could call upon were, in fact, al-Qaeda. That safe zone hasn't existed since the United States intervened in Afghanistan. It kind of existed and still does to a certain extent in Afghanistan. I mean, sorry, in neighboring Pakistan in the tribal areas, although it's not as safe as it was for al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda has seen a great diminution in its strength and its ability to mount complex foreign attacks of the kind that we saw in 9/11. That said, the threat has metastasized to other parts of the world, mostly in the Middle East, and has not been reduced in terms of the threat that foreign jihadi, al-Qaeda, the Islamic State pose to regional friends of the United States and to foreign facilities run, leased by the United States in the Middle East and other parts of the world. We've seen the threat increase in Europe. There have been arrests of jihadis or extremists associated with the Islamic State, both in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in France, other parts of Europe. And so there's no doubt that the threat of an attack has in some ways increased, in other ways diminished. But let me talk about the threat per se. I think our government and other governments always take a worst-case scenario or practice a worst-case scenario when viewing these threats. And they've made the threat of the Islamic State and al-Qaeda the modern-day equivalent of the Soviet nuclear arsenal. They cast it almost as an existential threat to the country, when in fact it's really not. It's more of a political threat. It's a threat to whoever is in the White House who fails or is unable, let me back that up, on whose watch a successful attack takes place. The blame automatically goes to whoever it is in the White House, whether it was their fault or not, from the opposition, in this case, the Republicans. We saw what happened when the son of, I believe he was a Nigerian diplomat, attempted to blow a plane up over Detroit wearing, you know, explosive underwear. I mean, the political fallout from that, from the FBI reading this guy his Miranda rights from the Republicans was just astounding. And to me, that just illustrates what the real threat is. It's more of a political threat to whoever's in the White House than it is an existential threat, which is the way the government treats it, to the country.
Maybe not whoever's in the White House. On September 12th, you'll recall that both George W. Bush and Rudy Giuliani were made into heroes simply for having been alive and in office during that failure. So it may be more a question of which party and how the media chooses to treat those parties. Is it not?
Well, you make a good point, although we do know that eventually it came back to haunt George W. Bush in more ways than one.
Well, I wish it would haunt him further. I asked about whether we were made safer because the CIA report from a few years ago that came out through WikiLeaks recently discussed the counterproductive nature of these drone strikes that have become central in Afghanistan. General Stanley McChrystal talked about creating 10 enemies for every one innocent person that you kill. A report last week from Reprieve in the United Kingdom said the U.S. was killing 27 people, innocent people, presumably for each one person, innocent or otherwise, targeted on its kill list. So you're talking about 270 to 280 enemies created for every name you put down on a list of people to kill, by very rough calculation. Can that not be counterproductive? Do people in Washington think it's productive, or do they think it's counterproductive and have some other motivation?
I think they think it's productive politically because you're able to say, look, we killed this guy, look, we killed that guy. I think that, you know, I'm going to take a bit of a contrarian view here. I think the jury actually is out on this. And the reason is because we simply don't have accurate data. Now, I understand Reprieve and other human rights groups, you know, put together these very in-depth, complicated reports. They spend a lot of time on these reports. But the fact is they are totally reliant on Pakistanis, if we're talking about the tribal areas, to do their reporting for them. And these are areas where, of course, Westerners have not been allowed for years. I used to go up into the tribal areas back in the 80s when I was covering the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. But, of course, we haven't been allowed to go up there for years. And so these groups are dependent on local Pakistani reporters, human rights activists. And the thing is that these people are caught between a rock and a hard place, the rock being the security forces, the hard place being the extremists. And they're sort of walking a fine line between two very deadly potential enemies. So that could have an impact on the way they report what's going on up in the tribal areas. As I said, we simply do not know accurately what has been going on as a result of these drone strikes. And in fact, to counter the arguments of General McChrystal and others that these drone strikes create new enemies, there have been occasionally Pakistani generals who have spoken quite, they've kind of left the reservation, so to speak, and they've been quite honest about the impact of the drone strikes, and they've said, we need more. We need more of these strikes because they are actually doing a lot of good. If you talk to some people, tribal elders and others in the tribal areas, and you can get them at a moment of candor, they too will say, you know what, we like these drone strikes because they are taking out people who have destroyed the culture of the tribal areas, the tribal law, the way the culture and the political system was set up there for centuries. And they destroyed this system which relies on tribal elders to make almost democratic-type judgment, where you have a controversy and they gather everybody together in jurgas and they vote democratically about what the answer to that problem is. That system has been totally devastated and destroyed, first by the Taliban, who went after the tribal elders, killed hundreds of them, and then by the army, which is the Pakistani army, which has been indiscriminately bombing and strafing the villages in North Waziristan over the last several months as part of this operation that's aimed at destroying the Pakistani Taliban. So, again, just sort of sum up, I take more of a view that we really don't know. One thing we do know, and that I reported last year, was that the government has been misleading the American people about who its targets have been and who it's been killing. I got a hold of highly classified documents that actually chronicled virtually every single drone strike that had been launched over the surge that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, instituted very quietly in the Pakistani tribal area at the same time that this overt troop surge was going on in 2010-12 in Afghanistan. And during that surge, they were, you know, the government was saying publicly that they are only going after, they're only targeting senior operational leaders of al-Qaeda and associated groups, who they never defined, by the way, that posed threats to the United States. And what these documents showed was that they were killing hundreds of people who they had not identified, who they didn't know. They would just sort of target cars that would drive out of compounds, quote-unquote, associated with a senior al-Qaeda leader without really knowing who was in those cars.
So if we really don't know whether or not, on its own terms, targeted killings of thousands of people is working or not. How responsible is it to continue not knowing and allowing such a policy to go on when we do know that innocent people are being killed? People are being killed based on signatures and behavior without so much as knowing their name. Drug dealers not engaged in combat are being put on the list, according to Der Spiegel this past weekend. People are being killed who are very low-level fighters resisting a foreign occupation in their country. We know that it's not what they're telling us, and we're picking and choosing which anecdotes to go by. I mean, we know that they discuss what lives might be saved by adding this person to the kill list and what innocent people might be killed in the process, and they do this moral calculation. If we're not doing the overall moral calculation of whether the policy as a whole makes any sense, how responsible are we being?
Well, you know, those are all really, really good questions. And, you know, as I said, a lot of this is obscured. I mean, if you pick and choose data points, one might be, well, there hasn't been another 9/11. Well, you know, at least according to the government and the intelligence community, that's a result of the fact that Al-Qaeda Central, as they like to call it, the core Al-Qaeda based, we think, still in the Pakistani tribal areas, has been pretty devastated by these drone strikes. If you take those across the border to the other side, to Afghanistan, and you poll people to a great extent, you know, 90% of Afghans don't want the Taliban back and are quite pleased by the fact that the United States is continuing to maintain a troop presence there in order to continue the fight, or at least guide the fight against the Taliban, which is in a resurgent mode right now. You know, there's been a major resurgence in Taliban violence and attacks, particularly in Kabul, over the last several months. You know, on the other hand, you know, look at Yemen. The drone strikes there seem to have done absolutely no good whatsoever, because you've had basically a Shiite tribal militia essentially take control of the capital, Sana'a. You know, the Al-Qaeda is still very much major military threat there, a major military force there. So that really hasn't had much of an impact at all. Drones are being used against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. That is a work in progress. And as you know, as I said earlier, that doesn't show any diminution, any sign that it's going to go away anytime soon. So I think it's a mixed bag. And yet, you know, it does allow the government politically to be able to say, see, we've really devastated these guys, and we don't have to put we don't have to spend blood and treasure doing it. We don't have to put troops on the ground in the Pakistani tribal areas to carry out these operations. We've got these drones. But then you hit all of those other questions that you yourself raised about even the constitutionality of some of these drone strikes, you know, like the ones that were used to kill four Americans.
It's a little surprising to me to say that 90% of Afghans across the country favor keeping a U.S. troop presence. I had not seen that
poll. Well, if 90% of Afghans don't want the Taliban back.
Oh, of course not. Who would?
and so, you know, if you talk to most ordinary Afghans, do not want the American, you know, you talk to people, they really, most Afghans, at least in my experience, don't want the Americans to leave yet. I mean, they do want them to go, but they don't want them to go yet. And I do have to say, you know, even though the war is continuing and it's as bloody now as it's, you know, there are more civilians who've been killed, I think, this year than in any year past.
Yep.
Government troops, Afghan security forces, I think I recalled a couple of days ago seeing statistics to show that they're taking more casualties than at any time before. And yet, you know, I've been going to Afghanistan since 1987, and the changes that have taken place in that country as a result of the intervention and the massive amounts of foreign aid that have poured into that place, and that Afghanistan is going to continue to be totally reliant on are just unbelievably amazing, at least to me, as someone who's been going to this place for, you know, almost 30 years.
And yet, if you think about the $750 billion at least in U.S. dollars spent directly on that war, almost all of it on war making, and the roughly $1 trillion a year spent on ordinary military spending now by the U.S. government justified by that war and related wars, and you imagine the humanitarian good that could have been done with that level of spending, Afghanistan would be a paradise. At the time we speak, it's one of the worst places to live on Earth, is it not?
It's better than it was, I have to say. For ordinary Afghans, as someone who, as I said, I've been going there since 1987, the changes have been quite astounding. Doesn't mean all good, and the war continues. And, you know, you also have to ask this very, very important question. What would have happened in Afghanistan if the United States hadn't invaded Iraq? I mean, it would be a completely and totally different situation. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind at all that, you know, the biggest blunder, or one of the biggest blunders, because there were a lot of them, that the Bush administration made when it came to the quote-unquote war on terror was to invade two Muslim countries and occupy them at the same time.
It might have made a bigger difference had they chosen to invade and occupy zero Muslim countries.
Well, you know, that's a hard one, as I said, because there was no doubt that there was a threat, that basically was a state within a state in Afghanistan. And it was a threat to the United States. Now, was there another way to have dealt with that situation? There may well have been.
Is it not the case that the Taliban would have sent bin Laden to a third country to be put on trial?
That was never going to happen.
Why not?
I mean, there were some negotiations, because you don't do that under Pashtun Wali. Under the tribal code, you don't do that. You have a guest. That guest is afforded your protection, your hospitality, and in this case, the guest was basically the treasury of Afghanistan. I mean, he was funding that government, if that's what you want to call it, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars of his own personal fortune, plus tens of thousands of fighters. The 055 Brigade was the elite al-Qaeda fighting force in Afghanistan at that time. Don't forget, they had virtually conquered the entire country. At that time, the opposition, the so-called Northern Alliance, was confined essentially just to one tiny piece of a northern province, and that was it.
They, you can't possibly mean al-Qaeda, you must mean the Taliban.
Well, but the Taliban were operating on al-Qaeda cash.
I wish we could go on. It's hard to stop. We've gone over time. I'm very grateful to you for coming on the program. Jonathan Lande is a reporter with McClatchy in Washington, D.C. Jonathan, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, anytime.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.